This episode of The Tour is brought to you by Canova Communications, leaders in creating multi-platform content and turning casual followers into devoted fans. Visit canovacommunications.com. When you pick up a Grammy for your first album, the doors may open, but the path you walk is still your own.
I realized I didn't have any new songs, and maybe I was done. Maybe it doesn't happen the same way. My story, my narrative isn't going to be like James or Joni. I'll just be done.
Hi, and welcome to The Tour. I'm your host, Ted Canova. Mark Cohn's first album got under our skin, and 27 years later, thankfully, it's still there.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane.
The first cut, Walking in Memphis, became his calling card. His solitary piano matched by his solitary voice.
She said, tell me, are you a Christian child? And I said, ma'am, I am tonight, walking in Memphis.
From the gospel he learned as a child to the version inspired by Paul Simon, Cohn took his own walk and invented a sound filled with interesting chords and rhythms.
If there's a God in heaven, he's got a silver thunderbird.
That self-titled debut went gold, then platinum, and he was off.
I'm asking you to be my true companion.
The success brought him face-to-face with his heroes, and 2 years later, he released The Rainy Season, with harmonies infused by Crosby, Nash, and Bonnie Raitt.
You look older today than I've ever seen yet. I think I know the reason.
But Cohn did what few musicians in that position would ever consider. He took a break. Not just once, but twice, and they were lengthy. When he found motivation to return a second time, he was leaving a concert and was shot in the head during an attempted carjacking. The shooting, along with Hurricane Katrina, led to a powerful record in 2007, Join the Parade, which took us from regret to acceptance.
Since I was lost, I was gone. Listen and leave on.
He followed it up with Listening Booth, 1970, where he covered his favorite songs from when he was 11 years old.
After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang down.
I sat down with Cohn before a gig in Salisbury, Massachusetts. What convinced him to go to Memphis? How does a rising star stop making music twice in his career and then regain the hunger? And since we were talking just days after the horrific Florida school shootings, does being shot give him a unique voice on gun violence?
Mark, I had a whole scenario of how I was going to interview you. And then I get in the car and American Skin is on, Springsteen song. We were going to talk about guns a little later in the interview, but I think it's just a sign just to start it out right now, given the situation in Florida. For you, it must have even greater meaning.
For those who are listening that don't know, I got shot in the head. Most people can't say that. Most people get shot in the head, don't live to do interviews about it. But I've been lucky enough to be one of those people that can talk about it. Some of the questions people asked immediately, were you targeted? Did the person mean to kill you or hurt you? And the truth of the matter is, that wasn't the case with me. It was completely random. And there was something about the fact that I wasn't targeted that made it a little less horrifying. And the fact that these kids are targeted makes it, for me anyway, all the more horrifying. But everything about it is horrifying, except for the fact that they are remarkable kids. And there's something about their age and the way they are articulating their feelings that gives me some hope. I feel a little bit more hopeful than I have up until now. It's not going to be soon, but over time, I think their ability to speak truth to power is going to take hold.
When I saw you a year and a half ago at the concert Across America to End Gun Violence,
21 shots.
When Jackson Brown was talking about gun violence, somebody in the audience near me yelled out, will you just sing? Do you struggle at all with just go out there and sing and don't wear your activism on stage?
Well, I have to say, for the most part, I don't see myself as an activist as much, certainly not as brave and courageous as Roseanne and Jackson. I just felt that concert was one I needed to do. even though, as Jackson has said, there's nothing more personal than your politics, I tend to keep my politics to myself for the most part. I don't have much of a struggle with that. Although I just have to say, I mean, I think Roseanne Cash and Jackson Brown and Bonnie Raitt and a lot of my friends and heroes that are amazing musicians, I think they're also tremendous activists, and I'm proud to know them and to learn from them. But I wouldn't call myself as engaged in that side of things as they are.
But you're the only one who's been shot in the head. Mm-hmm. Do you see a possible opportunity for you to step up your activism?
Well, it's a good question, man. I mean, it's something I've thought about off and on. I think there's a lot of room for me to learn a lot of things. I think that's the case with all of us, right? And maybe I should step up my activism. At the moment, I just haven't been comfortable doing so. I don't know how to explain it. I think I'm still just absorbing the way some of my friends and my fellow musicians handle some of these things. I just don't want to start talking about something unless I really understand it and can lend an intelligent voice to the dialogue and the conversation. And other than just saying what I can about gun violence, which I feel I have a particular stance on because of my personal experience, I sort of lay out so far.
All right, let's turn to the music then, okay?
Okay.
I wonder what your music would sound like if you didn't venture down to Memphis.
Well, I don't know if I'd even be making records if I'd never ventured down to Memphis. I mean, that trip was a very lucky, fortunate thing. First of all and foremost, because I got to meet some amazing people. And what I experienced and how I felt and the transformational power of the music I heard in my first trip down there led me to write a song that seems to have resonated with a lot of people for a lot of years now. So that's the secondary payoff, which is huge, of course. It's my calling card, that song, and it's given me my career. But you're right. I mean, if I'd never gone down there, I don't know if I'd ever, if I would have ever found my songwriting voice. That was the beginning of my doing that.
Well, before you found your voice, you were a kid listening to Van Morrison in your bedroom.
Well, when I was growing up in Cleveland, I was a huge music fan already. When I was 11 or 12, Van Morrison, Neil Young, Jackson Brown, some of these people that I know now and am friendly with, they were my heroes. And I spent hour upon hour under my headphones in my room, blocking out whatever was going on in my house downstairs, my parents fighting, my brothers fighting, just tuning out and getting deep into this music that I loved. All I wanted to do was find a way to do that myself, you know, because I was so moved by that music.
But it was your brother who taught you a Ray Charles song on the piano?
Yeah, my brother was a great piano player. I have three older brothers, and unfortunately the brother we're now talking about passed away a few years ago.
What's his name?
Steven, and he was a great piano player, way better than me. And yeah, he had a band that used to practice in our basement, and he wasn't as into the singer-songwriters as I was. He loved Burt Bacharach and Ray Charles and Jimmy Smith, and he played the organ. And he had this red and white painted upright piano in our basement, and his band, a trio called the High Fives, would practice down there, and they would occasionally let me sit in on bongos. That was my instrument.
How old were you? Were you like 10?
Not even.
Not
I was
even
like 7, 7 or 8 years old. And that's when I said, Steve, can you teach me that song? And that song was What I'd Say by Ray Charles. And he taught me that beginning lick. And I was off and running after that.
Well, let's go to your debut album. Who has a debut album, self-titled, that every one of the songs on it could be a standalone hit by itself? While you were writing it, what was going through your mind?
Well, that's a good question. What was going through my mind? Well, first of all, just getting signed to Atlantic Records, which happened a couple years before the record came out, and it took me a couple of years to make that record. Getting signed was an enormous occurrence. It's something I had dreamed about my whole life. Being on a record label like Atlantic or Warner Brothers, one of those, was a dream come true because all my heroes were on those labels. So that was the first thing that was life-changing. And then I remember part of my deal said that I would be able to make a second record if my first record sold 50,000 copies. So that's all I cared about. That said, I secretly knew when the record was done. I didn't know it was going to win a Grammy. I didn't know there would be any hits. But I knew it was going to sell 50,000 copies at the very least. And of course, you know, you're right. I was very fortunate, although I also think it's a very strong record.
Riding on the Gold Street. yeah, she keeps on riding.
The sky opened and the rain came down and washed away everything.
She keeps on riding.
You had said that your songwriting is something that you were constantly trying to do through most of your life, but you did it badly mm-hmm. up until the mid-80s, that your songs just weren't that interesting. So take me to the place and the time that your bad songwriting turned into this incredible debut album.
Memphis, that's the place.
Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam.
I can't explain it other than when I came back from Memphis after going to Al Green's church where I heard him preach, I met this unknown woman named Muriel who was singing gospel songs in this little ex-slave commissary that was now this eatery that served catfish and fried pickles. Something about the power of music really impacted me on that trip more than anything else ever had, so much so that I started to write this song, Walking in Memphis, within a few days of leaving there. I wrote that and Silver Thunderbird and True Companion and a couple of other songs from the first record all in the course of a couple of weeks. And I knew I had found my voice. That was all that mattered at that point. You know, that was it.
Well, someone else knew you found your voice because in 1992, you got a Western Union telegram that said, "Dear Mark, congratulations on your Grammy nominations. I wish you the best of luck. I voted for you, Billy Joel."
Right.
That must have been such a reinforcement that you were onto something.
It was. It was fantastic. I've had a lot of those experiences. I've been so lucky. I mean, probably one of the greatest parts of what I've done over the years is just been able to meet my heroes and sometimes collaborate with them. And yeah, getting the support from Billy was great. I had played a show with him right after the record came out. He was a big fan. He wanted me to show him how to play Silver Thunderbird. And I kept thinking, well, I can't believe I have to show him how to play this song because he has the greatest ear. That was a high point for sure.
So what was it about 1991 and 92? Was it the convergence of a lot of things going your way?
That was still the time when there were a lot of big pop records that were in the top 10 or 20. Mariah Carey, Whitney. All I know is that Walking in Memphis, when it started with that very sort of solitary piano riff, and my voice with no band until like the second verse.
Put on my blue suede shoes and
it was so different that it stood out.
Touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain.
That was one of the things that worked about it. Other than that, I think I wrote a good song. I think I sang it well. I think Atlantic Records did a really great job in getting people to hear it at radio stations and to play it, give it a shot. And when it got a chance to be played on the radio, people responded. That's all that Atlantic cared about, right? They got phoners. That's what they were called. People would call the station and go, "Who is that?" And that's what a record company was looking for. It's like there was another artist on Atlantic that had a single come out the same week as mine, and she was the highlighted artist. They were going to put everything they had behind her. But her song didn't get as much radio phone response as Walking in Memphis. And so they kind of switched alliances, I guess, and said, maybe we'll pay attention to this record. And then I was very fortunate, too. People like John Landau, who manages Bruce Springsteen, and Bruce loved Silver Thunderbird. And they called the head of Atlantic and said, you need to pay attention to this artist. And all those things coalesced into a successful debut.
Well, let's talk about Silver Thunderbird. Did you think the lyrics before the music?
Don't you give me no Buick.
You're a genius to come up with the piano and the harmonizing that comes in later, the repetition. Must I go on or can you?
No, that's enough. Thank you. That's very sweet. I don't remember how I wrote it either. I tend to write a little of each and go back and forth until I get to the end. I've rarely written a whole piece of music without lyrics. I've rarely written a whole lyric without any music. So I'm constantly going back and forth. So I don't really remember, but I have a feeling that's how it was with Thunderbird. I'm very fond of that song. I think it's a really, really strong song. It's got a really unusual and interesting rhyme scheme, which I only kind of was aware of looking back on the writing of it. I wasn't trying to do that. And I had written several versions of a song called Silver Thunderbird. My dad had a Thunderbird. I knew I wanted to pay tribute to him in my music. And I wrote many, many versions of that idea before I hit upon this lyric and that chord pattern.
Well, let's turn to True Companion. You talk about Springsteen, and you were sitting in the backseat of a New York City cab when Tunnel of Love inspired you.
Oh, yeah. There's a song on Tunnel of Love called Walk Like a Man, which is about a wedding. And I remember thinking how brave that was of Bruce to write about something so vulnerable and sweet and tender and yet really poignant. And I know that was the jumping off place for me with this song, True Companion. I wrote the lyrics anyway in the back of a cab. Now there's a song, I guess I wrote the whole lyric before I had really fleshed out a chord structure, even though I think I had a melody, but yeah, I wrote, I think about 90% of it on one trip from like 77th Street in Manhattan down to Midtown.
And Midtown, did you get out of the cab and sing it to your girlfriend turned wife in a very embarrassing situation?
Yes, I read it to her.
Baby, I've been searching like everybody else.
I read her the lyric, only thinking,
How happy you were that you just nailed another song.
I just wrote a good lyric, yeah. And I looked up and she was in tears and I thought, this is really better than I thought.
Yes, I'll climb a mountain.
And then I realized she was crying because she thought it was a proposal. I think I must have had in the back of my mind that I was thinking about my own wedding, but it hadn't occurred to me that reading her the lyric would make her think it was a genuine, authentic proposal.
My arms are reaching out.
And in fact, I did propose at some point afterwards and ended up having two beautiful children with that lady.
Congratulations.
I hit upon something with Walking in Memphis, Silver Thunderbird, and True Companion. The whole record seems to have resonated, but those three songs in particular, it's interesting. The manager that I had back in the day when I was just signed, and he said to me 27, 28, 29 years ago, those three songs will be hard to top.
Wow.
And he was proven right.
The Grammy that you won is tucked right near the Bob Dylan book that he signed for you. What is the inscription in that book?
My Grammy sits on top of a few books, and the one that it's right on top of is this lyric book of Bob Dylan's. He'd given me, after I met him in Australia, he gave me his copy of his lyric book, which was remarkable in and of itself. But the inscription says, "To Mark, if you're looking for songs, there are some in here." Best wishes, Bob Dylan, Australia, 1992, which is so perfect, right? I mean, so underwhelmed at his own wonderfulness, but also pushing the catalog. It was so great.
Right. Did you think 1992 was just going to repeat over and over and over, Mark?
I did. I hoped it would anyway, but you know, that's not the way it works out. I look back on that now and go, that was a young thing of me to think. It's interesting. I look back on my second record, which I personally think is maybe my best record from start to finish.
We're talking about The Rainy Season.
That's The Rainy Season, right. But you know, I look back on it and I go, well, Atlantic is just gonna keep supporting me and you know, doing what they've been doing and I'll keep doing what I do. But the truth of the matter is I kept doing what an artist should do, which is growing and following something other than what the record company expects. So I made a second record, The Rainy Season, which is very, very different. It's mostly guitar oriented. There's not a lot of piano. And I think the record company didn't quite know what to do with it, even though I think it was a really strong record. And I think some of the people there did too at the time.
Don't talk to when shooting stars are falling.
But yes, I would have loved it to have been the case that I was able to just keep doing what I wanted to do and that the record label and my audience would follow suit. Sometimes it works that way and sometimes it doesn't.
Do you think in retrospect, continuing with the same tone of the first album for another couple of years would have been a different way to go? Or creatively, you just couldn't imagine doing that?
Yeah, the latter. I mean, I just didn't feel like there was an option. I first of all, it is true what they say. You have your whole life to write your first record and maybe 6 to 10 months to write your second. That was kind of the case. But I was also from some of those songs, Walking in Memphis and everything, they came out in 91, but I wrote many of them in 85. So by the time 93 came around and it was time to make a new record, I was 7-8 years down the road musically, and I had a whole world tour behind me under my belt, and I was older and I'd experienced different kinds of things. I didn't want to keep writing about my childhood. I didn't want to, you know, I just started to write what felt true. And yeah, I just didn't feel like there was an option to keep, you know, doing what the record company needed or what my audience might have expected. I could have been a lot more shrewd about it, no doubt. But listen, I'm happy with the way it all turned out in the end.
You took a couple of years off, and I'm really intrigued by the two gaps mm-hmm. of your career. The first one was 1993 to 1998.
Yeah.
What were you doing?
Oh boy, well now we're getting into the depths of it all.
Have you talked about those 5 years? Because no. I really don't see.
You're one of the first people to really ask, and I'm trying to decide if I want to really answer. What was I doing? I was trying to rescue my marriage. I was trying to be there for my children, who I had, my son in particular, who was literally born, oh, I guess 5 months after my first record came out. So that was a year of two enormous births in my life. And I, you know, at the time, I had to give most of my attention to that record and not to my boy. So by the time 90, what was the gap you said?
93 to 98.
Yeah, by the time the rainy season was already out and I toured a little bit, I remember I had a terrible panic attack on stage one night, which scared me because...
Where were you?
I think I was in Toronto or Quebec, somewhere in Canada. I felt like I was going to have a stroke or something. I was just overwhelmed with fear. And I couldn't name it or really understand it at the time. I've you know since understand it pretty well. But I realized my marriage was falling apart. I hadn't been home. And I needed to pay attention to my life and to my children and to my wife at the time and see what needed to be done. If we could save our marriage, if we couldn't save our marriage, but I knew I wasn't going to find the answer in a tour bus. So I got off the road and really paid attention to my personal life and to my inner life. And I think I had to admit to myself that I probably had something close to a nervous breakdown. Mm. I certainly had panic. There's no doubt about that. The panic kept on going even after that concert. And I just felt unsafe in the world. I didn't feel like I wanted a tour. I just wanted to be home.
Even with all of that success, when you were home for those 5 years, did you resent having to be home to kind of sorted out that, gosh, that was the other me, that was the fantastic year that very few people have had with a debut album? Were you comfortable being the married guy and the father of a young child?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was my decision. Nobody told me I should do it or anything. That was just my instinct that it was now time to pay attention to my real life. Not to say that my career isn't my real life, but, you know, when you have a kid, you've got other responsibilities and priorities. And I had not made my son my priority. And then my daughter was born in 94. So I just needed to be there. And I had no qualms about it or any resentment whatsoever. It was my decision, and I would do it the same way again.
You came back with a real polished album in 1998, Burning the Days.
Tonight I cried the tears of a child.
More instrumentals, more heavily produced, but I still hear some songs from the first two albums. I love Healing Hands and Saints Preserve Us. Mm. Those two songs could have been on your debut album, it sounded.
I think you're right.
I lay down and the light streamed across my face.
Oh, I'm glad you like those. I think those are the two, and Olana is another one from that record. There's three or four songs from that record that still hold up for me really well. Yeah, Saints Preserve Us is like Ghost Train from my first record, about the day my mom died, only Saints Preserve Us is written from my brother Steve's perspective.
Saints Preserve Us, we're all going down.
There's a line in that song that says, the baby was crying and I tried to block it out.
The baby was crying and I tried to block it out.
that's my brother talking, but I'm the baby because he was my older brother and I was two when our mother passed. So I'm glad you like that song. I rarely play it. People rarely mention it. So you've already brought up a couple of things that nobody's ever asked me. But I think those songs hold up well, too.
You know, you are such a big fan of Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Browne. And I read that there was a song that on your debut album where James Taylor backs you up. But one day you're on stage and you turn around and who was there backing you up? Do you recall?
Oh, dude, I certainly do. Yeah, James sings the background part on Perfect Love.
Just the perfect love.
But one night at the Universal Amphitheater, I was opening up for Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I was doing a bunch of shows with them. And I look over, and right at the time when James would come in, but because obviously James didn't come on tour with me, I would just sing the background part as well. But I look over, and I realize there's other voices chiming in, and I look over, and my background choir singing James's part, but in harmony, was Crosby, Nash, Jackson, and Bonnie Raitt. And it was just, okay, you know, if I ascend to heaven now, it'll be okay. It was gorgeous.
That's unbelievable. It takes us to the second gap that I'm really intrigued about, 1998 to 2007. Mm-hmm. We talk about how you were shot in 2005. Mm-hmm. And by the way, your fans want to know, are you suffering any fallout from the shooting?
Nothing at all. I mean, I did have some post-traumatic stress, but totally fine now.
Great. But before being shot, 1998 to 2005, another seven-year gap. What were you doing then? I ask respectfully because you are a beloved musician who comes and goes, and we hate when you go.
That's so sweet. These are great questions. People don't normally ask these things. Where did I go? I remember talking to Ben Wish, who I co-produced my first couple records with. And I remember having a conversation with him, I believe right before I went on that tour where I got shot. And I've gotten used to the fact that I have long periods where, whether I'm anxious or not or whatever, where I just don't write. It's just time to absorb. And sometimes those cycles are years long for me. They're can be very frustrating sometimes. I'll try to push it and write things that, you know, just to be a writer, to remind myself. But very often, those songs just sound contrived and they don't interest me. And I would never think twice about releasing them because I'm not even interested. So who would I think is interested? And I know, God forbid, if something I've written that I don't like becomes popular, then I have to keep singing it. That's horrifying. So where was I? I was seriously wondering if the people that I had loved growing up, like James and Joni and all these people that had these beautiful records and then went on tour, had another record, went on tour, had another, you know, that was the cycle. I realized I didn't have any new songs and maybe I was done. Maybe it doesn't happen the same way. My story, my narrative isn't going to be like James or Joni. I'll just be done. And I remember saying to Ben Wish, the songs aren't coming. I really don't feel like touring. In fact, I'm kind of scared of it. Maybe there's something else for me. And I remember just saying that out loud. I think it scared me. I decided I would go on the road and see if that inspired me. Then, of course, I got shot, which didn't initially help the matter. But strangely enough, ultimately, it was sort of inspiring to go through something like that. Because as has always been the case with my records, I usually write a record when I've got something I need to work through. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I needed to work through almost dying. And so a record did come out of that. But those long stretches of time are me being a dad, me being an involved husband, hopefully, and me just waiting for the songs.
And that second gap, you fell in love a second time.
Yes.
And had more children.
Yes.
And you were content, or were things stirring for those years?
Mostly content. I would say that after I got shot, something changed in me. David Crosby said to me, you need to be on the road. You need to play. That's part of why you're here. It's great that you want to be present for your kids, but you also have an audience. Don't take that for granted.
Was there any concern, though, that in your first marriage and having young kids and you had the panic attack in Canada, now you get a do-over?
Mm-hmm.
You have another marriage, you're having more kids. Was there a concern, even though Crosby's recommending get on the road, you're a musician, that look what happened that other time and I have a marriage to do over?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I not to only a marriage to do over, but a raising of children to do over, right? I had four kids now, two of them were very young, and the other two were still pretty young themselves too. So yeah, I felt like I needed to be where I was. But then I started to realize, no, I think I can try to balance this a little better. And I got a hunger again for being out on the road. And I after being shot, I think I've done more shows since that event than I had done in my previous 10 years of being a musician. So I've never loved being on the road more. And now I can sort of customize it to the way it works in my life. I don't have to go out 5 months at a time. I don't have a record company to answer to. I'm not running for office. I'm just making my music.
That's the positive side of the changing record industry. The downside is that people don't buy albums anymore. And I know that that bothers you as it does me.
It bothers me to the, I mean, it's the fact that they don't buy them is terrible, but I just miss making them, right? That I know even if, well, number one, I don't make that many anyway, as we've been talking about, but it's the art form that got me interested in being a songwriter. It was the album. And the fact that you just, even if I put out a new album, knowing that some people aren't ever going to hear it the way I'd like them to listen to it, I miss that too.
I talked to Chris Wood of the Wood Brothers.
Love them.
And I asked him the same question, that these days you could cut one really good song and tour off that song, figuring no one's buying songs 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way to 12 on an album anymore anyway.
Correct. You know, which in a way kind of leaves you open to different ways of doing things. I mean, I've been thinking more and more about concepts for EPs. You know, just putting out 4 songs at a time. There's no rule anymore that it has to be an album length thing, unless, of course, you sign a deal that says that's what they want. I actually am now beginning to enjoy the idea of who I might do smaller collaborations with that don't necessarily have to be full albums, but might be just as creatively interesting and inspiring.
Well, in 2016, you did a little of both with the release of Careful, What You Dream, Lost Songs and Rarities, which is really tremendous. Those are basically your basement tapes, your
right.
demos.
Right. Sounded good.
Rolling. Take 7.
I was expecting to hear you singing into a cassette. Mm-hmm. These are fully produced songs, these demos.
Some of them. I mean, Ben Wish, who I mentioned earlier, if I would write a new batch of songs, this is before getting signed to Atlantic, I'd write a bunch of songs. And then Ben, who was a really great engineer and had access to really good studios, would say, you know, you can come in after the session at like 10 o'clock and we'll just record your demos.
And while the moon was racing past.
And my demos just ended up, for the most part, being me at a piano, but recorded really well. And then if Ben and I really liked a performance, if we had extra time, we would sweeten it with a mandolin or a violin or a synth of some kind, but always staying true to the song and the vocal sound. That was something that Ben really helped find, was the sound of my piano, the sound of my voice, and he was a big part of the way the first 2 records sounded.
But I just drive on by.
But when I listen to that and I hear Hold On For Me,
you were standing at the station saying, hold on for me.
Street of Windows.
Cause I can see your green eyes shining.
Careful What You Dream.
There's so much I want to tell
you. Mark, I'm thinking that this 2016 record of demos, how can't that be your second album in 1993? It's tremendous that you were sitting on these songs that you didn't even remember you did.
I forgot most of them. It was really a surprise to go back into the vaults and to hear some of these songs. A few of them I remembered because they'd been used as B-sides overseas. But the ones you just mentioned, for the most part, I had totally forgotten about. And you're right, it could have been some of those songs almost made it to the first record. There's a song on there called From the Far Away Nearby.
I send up a prayer
if you blow me some kisses.
Which almost made it to the first record, but one of the last songs I wrote was called Ghost Train, which comes right after Memphis. And both songs, Far Away Nearby and Ghost Train, are pretty much about the death of my mom. And I didn't want to put both of them on the same record. I thought it was too much of the same theme. So Ghost Train won out. But there were a bunch of songs, and that one included, that could have been on the first or second record.
When you released the demos, you also released an EP. And it's the first ever demos of Walking in Memphis and True Companion. Is it four versions of Walking in Memphis?
At least, I think, yeah. I mean, I did a dozen versions of that over the years, but those are four that I chose to include.
Let's talk about 2018. I read that you are writing along with your collaborator and producer, John Leventhal. Yeah. How's the writing coming?
Slow. Hate to say it. I do have three and a half songs that I like a lot. And I was largely inspired by just writing with other people over the last year or so, which was really lovely. But writing for myself can be a complicated thing. And, you know, here's the funny part again, right? I'm trying to write during a time when there is no personal turmoil. In fact, I'm about as happy as I've ever been in my life. This is always a weird thing for a songwriter, right? You're happy for your happiness, and it's like, damn. And I think it was Neil Young who said, when they asked him, why are so many of your songs so dark and sad? And he said, because when I'm happy, the last thing I want to do is ruin the moment and write a song. I want to enjoy my happiness.
Right.
I hope that's not the case. I mean, listen, one of my favorite songwriters, maybe my favorite, is Paul Simon, who has written so many happy songs. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, there's so many obviously deeply poetic and poignant and beautiful, introspective, gorgeous songs. But he's written a lot of songs that just make you want to dance. And I'm looking for my way into that world still. You know, that just writing a great song doesn't mean it has to be dark. And doesn't mean I have to be in a dark place. But I'm trying to find my way there.
I had read at one point that someone said, if you need to get inspired, you need to change your scenery.
James Taylor. He said, do a geographic. That's what he called it. And he said what worked for him when he was stuck was to go somewhere he'd never been. He would take his guitar, put it in the back of the station wagon or whatever he was driving, or hop on a train or take a plane and go somewhere he'd never been. And that, in fact, was what convinced me to go to Memphis, because I was feeling stuck for the first of many times over the years. And I ended up going to a place that really, who could have predicted, but it really did open me up.
Do you think now in 2018 there is a location that Mark Cohn should go to take that advice from James Taylor to get inspired?
Well, it's funny. Now that you mention it, I wonder. You know, it's not something that you can contrive. I just have to see where this road takes me and try to be open to what I'm supposed to follow. There's a song that I wrote a long time ago that was supposed to be on the second record. It's called The Calling. The chorus really, and I still just started doing it live now again. It says, like a priest or a missionary, I'm only following a calling. And that's how I feel.
Like a priest or a missionary, I am only following the calling.
A lot of what I do is just trying to suss out where I'm supposed to go. You know, this is a lovely, lovely life I have where I write something that is important to me and I get to share it with people that, for reasons I will never understand, it resonates for them. But in the end, it really is just like a priest or a missionary. I'm following some sort of calling, and I don't know where that place I could go now would be, but I'm going to try to stay open to listening to what I'm supposed to do next. And I'm not sure what that is.
Well, we benefit by you having a calling. Mm-hmm. And a guy from Cleveland, a little boy from Cleveland, mm-hmm. who can get exposed to Memphis and the South and have a soulful voice doing gospel as a white Jewish guy. Come on.
Yeah, I've had an interesting journey. And I, you're right. I hear you say that. And I go, how did I get here with that combination of of influences. I do know how. I mean, it all makes sense to me when I think about it. When my mother died, there was a lady who looked after me. She used to sing to me all the time. That was the earliest music I heard, was gospel music. And loved it from the first time I ever heard it. And then came the singer-songwriters, and then came the God of Paul Simon, who sang this beautiful singer-songwriter music and infused it with gospel. So to me, when I heard Loves Me Like a Rock and Take Me to the Mardi Gras and all these songs where the Dixie Hummingbirds were singing with them, I was like, this is heaven times two. They're these beautiful, deep, poignant lyrics, gorgeous chord progressions, and it's gospel. You know, it was everything. I've been trying to follow in those footsteps.
Mark Cohn, thanks so much. You're so gracious opening up. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. They were really, really, it was a fun time. Interesting. Thank you.
For a musician who's looking for signs, maybe in a location or within his own heart, Mark Cohn has more songs in him. While his narrative may not be like James or Joni, as he wondered, his story has been one of truth-telling and taking us places where we, too, found ourselves. Well, that does it for this episode of The Tour. I hope you liked our conversation. Go ahead and share it with your friends and followers, and do me a favor, write a review on iTunes. It'll help more people find us. Thanks for listening to The Tour. This episode has been brought to you by Canova Communications, leaders in creating multi-platform content and turning casual followers into devoted fans. Visit CanovaCommunications.com. I'm your host, Ted Canova. Remember, music makes it all better. See you next time.
Saw the ghost of Elvis on Union Avenue. Followed him up to the gates of Graceland, and I watched him walk right through. Now security, they did not see him. They just hovered round his tomb. But there's a pretty little thing waiting for the king down in the jungle room. When I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis. Catfish on the table. They've got gospel in the air. Reverend Green, be glad to see you. When you haven't got a prayer, but boy, you got a prayer in Memphis. Piano every Friday at the Hollywood, and they brought me down to see her, and they asked me if I would do a little number, and I sang with all my might. She said, tell me, are you a Christian, child? And I said, ma'am, I am. Tonight, walking in Memphis, walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis. But do I really feel the way I feel? Walking in Memphis. I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis. But do I really feel the way I feel? On my blue suede shoes, and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain.